doing that. Learn something new every day.
Mm-hmm. There's a very a counterintuitive premise that animates the Jewish law of tzedakah. We'll contrast that to a certain element of the holiday of Purim. There's a lot of connections between the holiday of Purim and tzedakah. We know that one of the mitzvot, one of the commandments of the day of Purim, is the idea of giving attention, special attention, and special gifts to the poorest in the community, the people that we don't just call poor, but people who are in many ways dejected. Really, people who, I think the best way to say it is to feel forgotten in life. There are always people in any community that feel forgotten. And it sometimes we were discussing, sometimes can be age-related, sometimes it can be financial, and sometimes it's really all of the above. It's people who in many ways are forgotten by the community, and Purim is a day of paying special attention to the people who fell through the cracks. And we discussed in weeks past the idea of the problem in terms of dealing with Amalek the first time around was that the Jewish people as a community had really forgotten people behind. There were people who were straggling behind, and those were the people who were attacked. So, of course, on the day of Purim, there's really very special emphasis placed on taking care of the forgotten members of our people, which is relevant every day of the year, but Purim, of course, is a special day for that. The theme of Purim, of how things can turn around, reversal, in the language of the Megillah, v'nahafochu, which, leads for great songs, v'nahafochu, things can turn around. I mean, you don't need, the deepest level. We don't need to be professors of literature here as our esteemed colleague to know that, that the message of turning things around is most relevant to people who are forgotten in life, and the message of hope, which is really why one isn't allowed to read the Megillah on Shabbos, because Shabbos is a day when you're not allowed to handle money and to give tzedakah, is that you wouldn't want them to have the experience of hearing the Megillah and not the experience of being able to immediately experience a little bit of that sense of a turnaround. And I think we mentioned, if not last week, then the week before, the idea that one day a year, it may not be a wise idea every day of the year, and it's always a bit of an ambivalent experience, is that anybody who asks for charity on Purim should receive. That's a special halacha of Purim, because it's a day that, in many ways, is a day of an emphasis on tzedakah. However, all that being said, there is quite a remarkable halachic distinction between the day of Purim and the general law of tzedakah that I just wanted to highlight briefly this afternoon. I think we're all aware, either clearly or just a latent memory for us, that or just maybe an intuition, that we all recognize that the highest level of tzedakah is to do so in a way that doesn't embarrass people. Obviously, a person who needs help is at risk of being very ashamed of that. It does not feel good to have to ask for help in ways large or small. And the halacha puts an enormous emphasis on human dignity when it comes to the laws of giving. So I'll just chart it out in two or three ways. There's a remarkable passage in the Talmud. The Talmud deals with these laws at the beginning of Maseches Bava Basra. There's a remarkable passage in the Talmud, really an unforgettable line, where the Gemara suggests that if you give a person the equivalent of what would today be $10 million, in other words, you not only take care of an immediate financial problem, but you essentially put the person in a position of more than financial security, let's put it that way. And you humiliate them in the process, you do so in a degrading way, you have not received credit for the mitzvah of tzedakah. It's a zero. That obviously highlights the idea that it's much more than financial restoration, it's really about dignity. And that's why the highest level of the performance of the mitzvah of tzedakah is to do tzedakah in such a way that the person can feel dignified and feel that, he's not or she is not in any sense impotent. And that's why the Rambam says the highest form of tzedakah is really to help a person onto their feet. As the saying that I grew up hearing goes, instead of giving him a piece of salmon, teach him how to fish, right? Why should he feel like he's not able to provide for himself? So giving somebody a job or giving somebody a loan, a person could get an interest-free loan and go out and get themselves a car and drive to work, and hold down a job and then pay you back, you've changed their life, without exaggeration. And all the intermediate levels of tzedakah reflect that. So, for example, it would be ideal if it would be what we call a double-blind act of giving tzedakah. Neither donor nor recipient knows But if you have to choose, you know, the Rambam writes, if you have to choose, if one party is going to know, it's obviously much better for the donor to know than the recipient. Why should the recipient have to be humiliated, you know, every day for the rest of his life when he sees this person, and to know that he needed help from that person? So the name of the game in tzedakah is really about restoration of the person's sense of self. And even in ways that are counterintuitive, just one very quick halachic expression of this idea is based on Psukim in Sefer Dvarim, towards the end of the Torah in Parshas Re'eh. The Talmud derives that even if a person had what we might consider to be a luxury, but they've grown accustomed to it. So, for example, a person drove a Cadillac, and suffered financial ruin. You know, we were wiped out in 2008, just totally wiped out. And now they don't have a car, so you would think, okay, so you get them a Honda. Nothing against the Honda. My wife drives a Honda. It doesn't mean anything to us, but not a Cadillac, right? So so the halacha says, were there no other needs in the community? Obviously, if there are people who are doing without food, and there always are, so this is a very theoretical kind of a point, but one would theoretically be obligated to restore that person to his previous level or her previous level. Now there, it's not about necessity, it's about the person's sense of self, right? So that again is another halachic expression of the idea that tzedakah is really dominated by a singular theme of making sure the person feels whole again and not just, dollars and cents. So the parallel to this phenomenon in tzedakah, but in exactly the opposite direction, is a halacha of mishloach manot. So let me just do an example. Let's say Lisa, known far and wide for her Mishloach Manot themes, famed Mishloach Manot deliverer, decides, okay, got to give Linda Mishloach Manot. And, with all of the bells and whistles, everything that you could possibly want or imagine in Mishloach Manot, and drops it off, but forgets to leave a note. So it sounds kind of harsh. But the halacha actually is, in that situation, if the person does not know from whom they are receiving these mishloach manot, then the donor, the one who gave the mishloach manot, has not fulfilled the mitzvah. It's the exact opposite of tzedakah, where anonymity is prized, it's desirable. See, in mishloach manot, just the opposite. And the reason for this, as explained by, it's really universally accepted ruling, the reason for this is that what Mishloach Manot is all about is creating a sense of community and fraternity. And so if you have this kind of amorphous floating gratitude to somebody somewhere, but you have no idea who it is, it doesn't bring specific people closer together. And the whole concept of Mishloach Manot is really to be brought much, much, much closer together. And that's why, even though anonymity is generally considered more than desirable, it's exactly what we're looking for. In tzedakah, just the opposite is the case with Mishloach Manot. Yet another halacha in the area of Mishloach Manot that really highlights this point is that, you could give the best gifts in the world. Person could give, imagine if you got Mishloach Manot and inside the Mishloach Manot there was a $1,000 gift certificate to Bloomingdale's, right? That would be an amazing Mishloach Manot. I mean,
as long as there's food and it qualifies.
But it's not something that you could eat at the Suda. It wouldn't be something that you could eat that day, right? So then, actually, one wouldn't have fulfilled the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot. Again, so it's about creating a sense of community to be experienced on Purim. Now, there is no rule that the person has to eat the Mishloach Manot that day, but ideally, it has to be ready to be eaten that day. And there's actually a third halachic expression of this idea. The Maharil, one of the great 14th century German authorities, the Maharil writes that it's actually the ideal level of Mishloach Manot to give cooked or prepared foods, as if, and this is really the impression that you get from the Gemara, that everybody cooks a meal and then sort of switches it. So you can imagine that is Lisa, you cook your meal, and then switch with Allison's meal. And that creates a very strong sense of community. And either you get together and you all eat it together, or you switch. So it's really about creating a very active and vibrant sense of community and fraternity on that day. So all of the desirability of anonymity in tzedakah, which we can really readily understand, is sort of flipped on its head. And the idea of Mishloach Manot is anonymity is not desirable. It's actually a problem if it is, and it's really about identifying in a very clear way who you are and, you know, what it is that you're doing and reaching out to form this community. Okay, so that, I think it can make some level of sense intuitively, but what I'd like to try to point out is I think that this actually in many ways resonates with a critical theme of the Megillah. The central question of the Megillah really is whether Esther is going to identify as a member of the Jewish people or not. Remember, she has, and we know the end of the story, so it's hard for us to experience this with any suspense. But remember, the central moment in the Megillah is the Jewish people are in dire straits. And Esther is in a position where she may be able to do something about it, but to do so, she's going to have to compromise her anonymity. She's going to have to identify. And Mordechai tells her, you have to. And she says, well, no, the king, we're not really, as we've spoken about in the past, we see each other very often. I don't know that this is such a good strategy. It sounds like a rather desperate attempt, but Esther goes ahead and she identifies in a very clear, unequivocal way, and through her choice of saying, I'm not Esther, the Persian queen, I'm Hadassah, the Jewish girl, I've been forced to play the role of the Persian queen, but this is who I am deep down, she, what I like to call, renounces her anonymity and identifies fully as a member of the Jewish people. That is the critical, critical moment of the story, and actually turns around everything, begins the process of turning everything around for the Jewish people. See, Mordechai is just the opposite. Mordechai, from the very beginning, is identified as an Ish Yehudi. But he was very much the exception in that regard. In that generation, the Megillah tells us that the overwhelming majority of Jews wanted to assimilate. They did not want to be identified visibly as members of the community. As a matter of fact, if we, you know, time the Megillah to right around the time that the Jews were allowed to go back to the land of Israel to rebuild the temple, we know that from Tanakh itself that a very small percentage of Jews went back. Cyrus, great King Cyrus, says, "Mi bachem Hashem Elokav imo v'ya'al." Anybody can go back and begin the process of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. And we learn in Sefer Ezra and Sefer Nehemiah and Divrei Hayamim, very few people. They'd grown very comfortable in the Persian Empire. And as a matter of fact, the Gemara takes it even further and says that it was, you know, a great status symbol for a Jewish person in the time of Ahasuerus to be invited to Ahasuerus's party, that 180-day party. They were dying to get in and to participate and to be a part of that culture. And Mordechai is really the exception as the Ish Yehudi. But the Jewish people are very much in the business at that time of suppressing their true identity. And that expresses itself through the Mishteh. They want to participate in his Mishteh. Then, of course, Esther, at her Su'udah, at her Mishteh, identifies herself quite clearly. I'm a member of the Jewish people, and my people are in trouble. And so then how I think elegant it is, and poetic really it is, of the halacha to say, I mean, you have to identify yourself very, very clearly as a member of the community. You can't give Mishloach Manot, which are really for the purpose of the Mishteh, the Suda, anonymously. Every other day of the year, you want to give anonymously. It's not just a good thing. That's the ideal way of giving to somebody. But on Purim, we reverse everything. And if you want to give Mishloach Manot, you can't do it anonymously. You have to do it in a clear way, identified as a member of the community, to be used on Purim, to participate in a Mishteh and a Su'udah, but a Mishteh and a Su'udah that's reflective of Jewish identity and not an attempt to suppress Jewish identity. So the halachot of Mishloach Manot are very poetically and elegantly designed to sort of reverse that pathology of assimilation that's really very much the story of the Megillah. And that's why, you know, anonymity and any kind of equivocal participation is not going to be a halachically valid way of expressing oneself in terms of Mishloach Manot and the Su'udah. just to mention one other halachic point in connection with this, but of course here, let me just, before I even say anything, that practically speaking, I don't think that anybody should drink. I don't think it's a good idea. I think that there are many, many halachic sources that repudiate the idea of drinking on Purim altogether. A lot of unfortunate, reckless behavior can come from it, dangerous behavior, things that are said that people deeply regret saying. I don't advise it at all. However, I just want to explain conceptually why the Gemara might have, at least at one stage in the Gemara, I don't think this is the Gemara's conclusion, but the Gemara in Megillah Daf Zayin very famously said, and you can ask any of our students here, they're all very excited by this Gemara, and that excitement has to be dealt with properly and responsibly and basically discourage them. But the Gemara does say that a person, in the context only, in the context of the Purim Seuda, mind you, in the context of the Purim Seuda, it's in the context of the Gemara's discussion of the Purim Seuda and the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot, which as we know are really integrated one with the other, the Gemara suggests that there's a concept of drinking on Purim in a way that causes one to challenge fundamental assumptions. The Gemara's formulation is Chayev Inish the Ivsume Befuraya Adilo Yada Bein Arahaman Labarach Mordechai, until the point that a person is no longer able to draw the distinction between Haman being the villain and Mordechai being the hero. It's obviously a very cryptic kind of a formulation. Why would it be the case that, you know, it would ever be appropriate to drink to that point? And as I mentioned, I'll just say very, very briefly, you know, there are many Rishonim, the Rambam included, who suggest that maybe going to sleep is the best way not to be aware of Haman versus Mordechai. I'm certainly not advocating any kind of extensive cognitive suppressing, drinking to the point of cognitive suppression. I certainly don't advocate that. But what exactly did the Gemara have in mind? So I would just point out one thing in conjunction with this, that the idea of sort of getting past superficialities and getting in touch with one's deepest self, the idea of whatever superficiality one is accustomed to demonstrating, whatever facades we do walk around with various days of the year, Purim is a day about owning up to your true identity. And of course, in the context of the Megillah, Esther having to make that critical choice, and what we're suggesting is that Mishloach Manot don't allow you to be anonymous, you actually have to identify to fulfill the mitzvah. So perhaps Chazal were taking it to the next level and say Purim is actually a day to identify in the deepest way possible. And sometimes relaxing inhibitions, at least in the theoretical way, would be a way for a person to really come out and say it, who they are in the deepest way. And then, of course, the idea that this would be done in the context of the Seuda, which really adds the poetic piece to this. Remember, in the chapter 1 of the Megillah, the Jewish people are participating in a Seuda as a way of suppressing their identity. They're saying we could be good Persians. You get to chapter 6 and 7 of the Megillah, where Esther is using the Seuda to come out with her true self. The idea of coming out with your true self in the Seuda, that would be my conceptual, though I stress, not practical, explanation of what it is that drinking is supposed to do. But in a theoretical way, the Purim Seuda is really a time of identification, clear, unequivocal identification as a member of Klal Yisrael, as a member of the Jewish people, and at the same time, really, in our own way, in our own lives, sort of recreating Esther's experience of making a choice. Am I the person that I pretend to be out there, or is there something deeply committed inside of me that I'm ready, willing, and able to express? Yeah, Mrs. Newmark.
Dressing up in Purim totally negates what you're saying.
You would think so. So I actually have a particular view of that. I think we mentioned this a few weeks ago, my personal view of that is the idea of putting on a costume on Purim is actually sort of a very pointed critique, a self-critique, if you will, that we're really masquerading around all the time. Yeah. And that on one day of year, that there's a certain degree of honesty where you kind of admit that you're wearing a costume. It's a way of sort of lampooning ourselves, that we're very often dressed up. We wear our normal clothes every day, but the idea is that we're really masquerading around. And the process of Purim is about whether or not we can get beneath that. So I think it's a way of calling attention to it in a satirical way. That's really where I understand that particular custom. Of course, all of the members of that generation, Esther included, were really struggling with this process of assimilation versus identification, as members of the Jewish people. So putting on the costume is, I think, a way of putting yourself back in Persia of that time, where the Jews were essentially costumed, and then the challenge is, throughout the day, do you go through this experience of identifying as a member of the Jewish people? You know, recreating Esther's experience, where you have to own up to it. That's the way I understand it. So it's not about assuming the alternative identity, it's about sort of going back to the starting point. Yeah, Alan.
It's like almost like the, I don't know if you remember, I think it was in 08, there was a sketch on Saturday Night Live where Hillary Clinton, who was running for president at the time, she wears a bride costume and has a Halloween party, and everyone comes in and says, that's a nice witch costume. And there's like this whole joke that she's dressed up as a bride, she's wearing a white gown, and yet nobody can see anything about her except that everyone perceives her as being a witch. So no matter what she wears, everyone now this is not a way of getting political, this is just the message.
No, I understand.
Of the skit. But like it was based on this idea that like no matter who you dress up as, people perceive, it almost highlights who you really are.
Very good. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that it's a way of actually highlighting the issue. So again, the Seuda and the Mishteh becomes a time, obviously enjoying the Purim triumph, but even more importantly, using the Mishteh as a means of identification. So I would, again, just to review what we said today, all of the various halachot that go into the Seuda of Purim, I think really do reflect this idea. The idea that the Seuda is linked to the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot, where you cannot be anonymous and you have to identify yourself as a member of the community. The idea that it really should be for that day, for Purim itself, and not just something for the long term, but that it's meant to be experienced on Purim, because Purim is the day of formation of this community and formation of this fraternity. And then finally, the idea of making sure that the Seuda is a very honest one, and not one where people are just going to engage in small talk, but hopefully really, come out with their true selves in the way that Esther did at her Seuda, and the way that the Jewish people of that generation very clearly failed to do when they wanted to participate in the Seuda of Achashverosh, I think is really the core idea. Just to conclude with that passage in the Gemara that I already alluded to, it's a very strange thing. The Gemara wants to know why it is that the Jewish people were almost completely destroyed in that generation. It's the question, right? Well, why is it that we deserved, to be within an inch of our collective lives? And the Gemara says because they wanted, or they benefited from the Seuda v'Achashverosh. And as we've raised in the past, what? They ate a little non-kosher. I think, right, that the idea is that they, this was a referendum, participation in the Mishnah and the Seuda v'Achashverosh was really a way of saying, this is where we want to be. We don't want to be back in Jerusalem, building the temple. We don't identify with that historical narrative. We want to be citizens of the Persian Empire. And of course, one of the central motifs of Jewish history is that the more we want to be citizens of the Persian Empire, the more the Persian Empire says, can't be citizens. Nobody was or wished to be more French than Captain Dreyfus, right? Captain Dreyfus did not identify as a member of the Young Israel of Paris. He identified as a member of the French General Staff. The problem is the French General Staff did not see Captain Dreyfus as French. And we all know the history of the first half of the 20th century in very large segments of the German and Austrian Jewish community that achieved the highest degree of assimilation, obviously, of any communities in Europe. Purim has a little bit of that as well. The more that you want to be a citizen of Persia, the more that the political winds in Persia will blow in just the opposite direction. Esther, of course, is the only one that can really pull it off. She's the only one that can really pass herself off as Persian, but at the critical moment, and during a Seuda, mind you, she comes out with her true identity. So ensconced and instantiated within the halachic framework of Purim is the idea of a su'udah, but again, not just for the sake of having a meal, but as a method of identification. Mishloach manot, it can't be anonymous. It has to be done that day when the entire Jewish community, when it's not just a meal, but everybody knows it is your Purim su'udah. And finally, at least again, in theory, in such a way so as to deepen a true and searching encounter with one's identity, and maybe there again you might find some conceptual, if not practical, justifications for a very significant amount of drinking, to the point where one's inhibitions are subdued. So the question of assimilation versus identification, which is something that every Jewish community in the diaspora and every generation has to deal with, is really very much at play in the Purim Suda.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Thanks for